Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look today at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, works out of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Back once again to be with us to talk about bugs, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions as we move along today. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to the Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question there. I think there's already a question or two posted there, as a matter of fact. We'll have to take a look. Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
Cool, wet spring.
Yeah, things have been slow.
Yes.
Although, you know, the one thing that's got my attention the last couple of days in the lab is people who have never experienced black flies are getting that lovely opportunity.
And, oh.
What's tough with black flies is they can blow a good distance away from their breeding source, which is always moving water. But it's so easy to identify the problem because you don't feel the bites. It's typically around the neck and the hairline. They often bleed after they leave, a little trickle of blood, and then a lot of people develop a real nasty welt.
Yes.
And so when I get those, somebody said something bit me, I don't know what it was, and then we start talking about it, I said it's a pretty easy one to diagnose.
Yeah, that's something that living on the lake, as we did for so many years, I had many, many, many of those bites.
Yeah,
many of them. I always weld. And you get these big welts, and they'd itch for a long time.
Well, yeah, it's amazing. I mean, people talk about 2-3 weeks before things start to settle down. And so it's so surprising because it is painless. So many other biting flies, like deer flies, you feel right away. But these little guys, you don't.
Ellen in Madison has a question for you, Phil. So let's go to Ellen. Hi, Ellen.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I'm pretty sure our yard is full of grubs. We have voles, I guess, or moles. I don't know which of the two that have absolutely annihilated our yard. And I'm trying to figure out, A, I guess if that's what we have, and B, how to get rid of them.
Okay. Well, it's a two-part question. I mean, there are things, moles will feed on grubs, but they also feed on earthworms. And you really do need to determine what's going on there because you can find chemicals to kill the grubs, but if you still have the earthworm source, the moles will still be coming there. And so, I know Dr. Craven talks about using these harpoon traps and whatnot as a method of dealing with the moles. Now, the grubs, I'm starting to see in the Madison area some reasonable numbers of Japanese beetle grubs in the lawn. And the one caution I'll give you is that unless the densities are up around 10 or 15 per square foot, there's probably not enough grubs in your lawn to hurt the lawn. Plus, this is not the time of the year to treat for that. Large grubs like the Japanese beetle grubs are there now are really not solvable with treatments because they're not feeding anymore. They're going to be transforming. If you do have that problem, there are some preventative products that could be put on from now on until maybe the first, second week of July that will prevent the next generation from coming. But as I said, the mole thing, I think you need to dig around, see what's going on. If it is the grub thing, that would be a solution, is to get some of these season-long grub control products, get them on, prevent next generation. But as I said, I've seen way too many cases where people have killed the grubs and then been disappointed in the results because the moles still have a food source.
There you
okay.
go.
Okay, yeah, because it seems like towards the fall, I guess, is when the worst of it comes in. So I'm wondering if
these are tunnels you're seeing along in your lawn, by the way?
Yeah, they're tunnels, and they're at the surface of the lawn, and they are everywhere. I mean, our yard is like a big sponge.
Yeah, it usually comes up around August, somewhere in September, maybe. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Jeff in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Got a couple slightly related questions for you, please.
Okay.
First one is, I've looked online and I've looked in Amazon and a couple other places, and I can't seem to find a good, comprehensive, fairly extensive guidebook or magazine or some sort of reference for identifying bugs in the Wisconsin area, and especially in the yard and garden and in the woods and in the house also. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is there's a particular spider that I see occasionally in the house, and he's an unusually looking critter, as that he's kind of you know, I guess not real small, but not gigantic either, with legs that kind of go straight out and back and then straight out in front. And except for the two front legs that reach quite a bit further out than the others, look like they almost have, like, pincers on them, like kind of like crab or lobster pinchers.
That real small critter, there's a critter called a pseudoscorpion. It's not a spider, but there are no spiders that I'm aware of that have pincers here. And so if there's a pair of pincers up on the front pair of legs, look under the name pseudoscorpion. It's a unique group of arthropods. They're beneficial because they eat carpet beetles and ants and those kind of things. And
that would be found inside the house?
Yes, there's one that's almost domesticated, and usually they're quite secretive, and you never see a bunch of them. It's, you know, one every couple, 3 weeks, and harmless to people. As they said, they're an odd-looking creature, and if you've never seen one, you know, it's such a surprise because it's such an odd-looking beast compared to the normal critters you see.
Right.
As far as books, a couple thoughts. My favorite book for people that yard and garden a lot is something called Garden Insects of North America. It's written by Whitney Cranshaw, and it's a Princeton University Press book. And it has just tons of pictures, and it has some of the indoor stuff. It has some, you know, beneficial insects. It has some big, ugly insects, and it's really quite comprehensive. It'll probably fall a little short, though, if you're a real naturalist and spend a lot of time outdoors, because it's really concentrating more on pest species and relatively reasonably priced. I mean, it runs somewhere, I think the list price is $29. I think I got my copy for $19 on Amazon.
Okay.
Another book to look at, if you're talking about the woods and area, there's a series of insects in the North Woods, spiders in the North Woods, dragonflies in the North Woods, and they do, is quite comprehensive for Wisconsin, and the insects in the North Woods kind of gives you one or two representatives of the more common families. So that's a pretty good book, too. But as a gardening book, I would pick that Garden Insects of North America.
And then what about your own website, Phil?
Yeah, I have an insect ID section on my website. And honestly, I'm very comfortable with the stuff I've got indoors. That's all the common stuff. I've got a reasonable listing of outdoor ornamentals, but with 25,000 different insects in the state, there's a lot of stuff I don't have. When I go looking for a site, there's a site called Bug Guide, which, if you know what you're looking for, is just an incredible site. I think where most people get frustrated because they have literally millions of images that if you're just looking under beetle, it's going to take some time going through. And so, as I said, it's a very great reference, but you have to kind of have a general idea what you got first to be able to really utilize it correctly.
Okay. There you go. Thank you very much, Jeff, for calling. Appreciate your call. Got an email from Adam in La Crosse. The other day, just before a thunderstorm, my wife and I stopped our bike underneath a freeway overpass. Shortly after getting off our bikes, my wife saw a tick on her leg. She brushed it off, and very shortly there was another one there. Then I looked at my feet and saw a few more there. I looked very closely at the asphalt, and we were standing on and counted about 20 ticks in our immediate area, all heading directly toward us. We quickly got on our bikes and rode off. You have any idea why there may have been so many ticks in one area? Well, were they ticks?
That seems an unusually high concentration, but the reality is if you stand still, ticks do react to the carbon dioxide and heat we give off, and so they are drawn in, but normally you don't expect them at that kind of densities. I would really like to see what the critter was, because, you know, that kind of habitat, you do see in game trails and walking paths and whatnot, especially people where dogs are frequent, that the ticks are really quite common right on the edges, and you get higher densities there than you would in the woods. But boy, finding 20 and even somebody's yard, I would say, is a high density, let alone in one little concentrated spot.
Yeah. Judith reminded me that we have a link on our Facebook page to your insect diagnostic lab, too. So people can just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and click right on it, and there it is. An email from Gary in Arena. Is there an insecticide that controls cutworms and won't kill birds? I went out with the flashlight one night and killed 50 of them.
Wow. It turns out that the new family of insecticides that are used in the garden are called synthetic pyrethroids, things like permethrin and the like, and they are very effective on cutworms. And to be honest, permethrin is registered to put on chickens to get rid of mites and the like. And so they really don't. The only wildlife issue they have is they're real tough on fish. So you've got to be careful if you're around fish ponds and whatnot with those particular products. But the permethrins and the bifenthrins and whatnot that are labeled for the garden are very good on cutworms. That's what we use agriculturally to kill cutworms in cornfields and the like. And as I said, really won't pose the birds any threat.
Tim and Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Tim.
Hi. A little bit of an odd indoor insect question. I'm sure all of them are kind of odd. But we had some flies that, from what it appeared, were living in the overflow of the bathroom sink.
Mm-hmm.
And they were black. They had wings that were really large for their body size.
Yeah. They're called moth flies or drain flies. And they get the name moth fly because the wings are hairy, which is not typical of flies. And sometimes when people smush them, they give kind of a powdery smudge. And so, and that's exactly the environment you would expect them. They breed on that kind of slime and organic matter. So they need some moisture and the organic matter. So usually just flushing that any way you can. You know, sometimes it's a brush. Sometimes you can use a plunger and get that kind of gook cleaned out and you're done with it. They're quite common in basement floor drains also. It's usually things that don't get a lot of water, and that's the problem with the overflow cut there, is that you get this accumulation of debris, but it's not like the drain proper that's getting water flushing it through all the time. And
Do they seem to have a really slow reaction time as well?
Yeah. In fact, a lot of times you'll just see them landing on things and they're quite easily captured or crushed. But, you know, the problem most people haven't connected the dots like you have is where the source is. And so they see these critters, you know, in the kitchen or in the bathroom and don't realize that, as I said, there is a drain or some other place that has this organic matter and moisture combination that keeps them happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, good news. I moved out yesterday. So.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Tim. Sue in Manitowoc, it's your turn now. Hi, Sue.
Hello. Oh, hello. I was at my son's in Milwaukee for Easter, and his porch was covered with box elder bugs. They also were coming into the house, and when I started spraying, they went under the siding.
Mm-hmm.
And so, no, I sprayed. I killed hundreds, but there were still more. And I wondered, should he get a professional person to spray for these because they were under the siding?
And yeah, but they'll leave. I mean, the whole trick about box elder bugs in the spring is they are basically waking up from spending the winter in sheltered sites, and they're leaving. There's no way they'll breed indoors. They're going out to the box elder trees where they feed on the seeds as they develop. Now, next fall, there is the potential that they will come back again. And so if you were to treat, that's a time to treat.
Okay.
Or the other thing, depending on the kind of siding, is sometimes you can tighten things up so they can't get underneath it. Now, you know, it depends a lot on the age of the house. You know, a lot of the newer houses, the siding is loose and they can get up underneath it, but they can't get in the house proper because they use some kind of house wrap or other things that keep things sealed well enough. But, you know, they're a nuisance. They don't hurt anything. But again, if you're going to try to control them, the time to do that is early September when they're congregating, looking for places to spend the winter, not the spring when they're basically waking up and trying to leave.
And Paul had emailed us, too, and said, what's the reason for the big explosion in box elder bugs?
Well, this one I've thrown my hands up because the typical patterns that we have seen with box elder bug, it's a native insect, has very few natural enemies, but the thing that controls it most often is a fungal disease. And so in wet years, they all get moldy and die. In dry years, we have high populations because we don't have that natural control. And so that's the pattern I've seen for the 34 years I've been chasing bugs. Last year, I would have predicted it was not going to be much of a problem in the fall. And it was one of the worst years we've seen in the last 10. And so I'm quite perplexed at what the story is. As I said, the patterns just didn't seem to be dry enough to keep them happy. But they definitely did have a good season. And again, we paid for it all winter long, really.
Thank you, Sue, for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today as we talk the world of insects. Lisa in Minneapolis, Minnesota has a question for you, Phil. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Interesting situation that we had. We have three small dogs. We live in the city. And this last week, each dog had a bite on them. It was about the size of a quarter with a red ring around it. I called my vet, and she told me that they had had similar people calling in and bringing their dogs in the last week or so, and she thought that they were either a yard lice or a sand flea. Now, my dogs get groomed every 4 to 6 weeks. I thoroughly searched the dogs to see any fleas, didn't see anything. The bites went away, and suddenly my husband and I have small welts on us. And so now we're wondering, do we need to treat the animals, treat the house, the dogs? What do we do? And I don't want to use chemicals. So
sure.
A suggestion for natural would be great.
Well,
I'll be happy to take, I was going to say, I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
Well, I mean, the first thing is the two terms that the vet used, I don't recognize, I mean, entomologically. And my first take on this is I really wonder if they were black fly bites. Because dogs can react in a similar manner, and the black flies have been out, and it's kind of a here, now, gone type of thing. You don't see it. But especially if you looked closely and it appeared to be a little bit of an open wound, and then you get this welt associated with it, and that's a reaction I would anticipate. And in dogs, any place there's a lot of hair, probably not. But if, the belly around the ears would be a classic place to see it. And now with you guys picking it up, too. Typically, again, it's around the neck area, the exposed skin area. Another thought, and it seems a smidgen early for this, but when we get mysterious bites, there is a bird mite that we associate with birds typically in their nests. And given the opportunity, sometimes they will bite people and pets, and you get this blister-like reaction. It's usually not as involved as a black fly bite as far as developing a big welt. But when I get mysterious bites, that's the first thing I think of. I really can't think of anything in the yard that would be, quote, breeding. And in the case of these bird mites, typically you find the nest and get rid of it. You could use soapy water to kill the mites if they're around. And they're big enough to see. They kind of look like walking pepper grains to me. If you get them on a white background, you can see that it's dust moving type of thing. So those would be my first two thoughts. As I said, yard lice, I don't know what that term refers to. Sand flea is often used to refer to no-see-ums, which are another little biting gnat that we see. So they're not a flea at all. True fleas, usually you see some flea dirt and you see the sign of the fleas on the animal, and usually you don't get that involved a reaction. In true fleas on people, usually what we see, the bites around the ankles, you get these little clusters of bites, which are quite characteristic. So as I said, I think this may have just been an odd phenomenon. The black flies are out. It's usually a very seasonal thing for a couple weeks, and now they're gone, I'm hoping.
All right, let's move on to George in Columbus. Hi, George.
Yes, good morning, Larry. I've got a similar problem to what other people have called in about. I live in a house that's about 150 years old, and I get insects coming in. And this year was a box elder plague, and last year was a ladybirds, and then previous years it's been flies, I guess cluster flies.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm asking about is there a color I can paint my house to discourage these insects from coming here?
Not really, because there's different things going on with each one of them. They're reacting to thermals. They're reacting to contrast in light and dark. And we really have not seen a lot of evidence that color plays a lot into drawing them in. So, I'll tell you that I've seen white houses maybe be a little bit more attractive to some of them. But I've seen brown houses have just as much problem. And again, in the case of the lady beetles, it's when you get the sunny day and you get that contrast from the sunny areas to the places that are shaded. They've done the studies where you basically just take a white board with black stripes painted on it. And as I said, it's amazing how strongly they're attracted to that contrast.
Oh.
Now, with the case of all those critters, maybe not so much the box elder bugs, because they don't seem to pay as much attention, but with the cluster flies and Asian lady beetles, if you had the same house in a totally wooded area that stayed shaded, so you're not having sun hitting any place, you'd have far less problem. So it's more having to do with the shade and keeping the sun away from it, because you'll notice that all these things seem to be attracted to that south and sometimes west side of the house.
Yeah.
As soon as the sun hits, that's what's drawing them in.
There you go, George. Thank you for calling. And Josh emailed us and lives in Altoona, in Eau Claire area there, and he's a fly fisherman, wondering if this spring will have any effect on the hatches that would be coming up, or if you know, Phil, of any large hatches that you're predicting will be coming up here in early June. If so, what time of day does a hatch usually take place?
Well, this gets complicated, and I wish my colleague Bill Hilsenhoff was our aquatic entomologist, and Bill is far more attuned to what's going on. I guess the first comment is that water temperatures in streams and rivers tends to be more constant than our outside air temperature, and so the activity of most aquatic insects is not as variable as it is the things that are terrestrial. But there are so many different aquatic insects, and, you know, whether we're talking the mayflies or the stoneflies or, you know, in the different families. And so, as I said, predicting, you know, I think people that work a particular body of water start to become very familiar with the normal hatches that they have there and, the species involved. But making predictions overall, I don't even get close to trying to do it because, as I said, there's just too many things going on, too many species going on. So nothing that I know is going to be out of the ordinary. And as I said, timing-wise, I don't think it's going to be, you know, we seem to be about 2 weeks behind in everything else terrestrial. But aquatic-wise, I don't expect to see that much difference.
And we had a Facebook comment from Bridget. I'm looking for someone or something to have at our Master Gardener booth at our fair in July. Something different from other years with a wow factor. We have the EAB in a little bottle and the demo wood. What else can we share with the public?
Well, you know, I like big and live. Typically. And so, you know, you might check with the local pet stores to see if they have any of these giant hissing cockroaches or those kinds of things. Because usually if you got something big and alive like that, you draw people in and then there's an opportunity to talk, you know.
Yeah.
We talk about teachable moments, but you get their attention. All of a sudden, insects are on their mind and then they'll come in with the kind of questions that they have. So that's what I would look for. Another thing you'll see are walking sticks. There's some big exotic walking sticks that are sold in some of the pet stores. You may ask around. This one you wouldn't let people handle, but tarantulas I've always found to be quite entertaining for people drawn in. But as I said, I would look for those kind of things. Now, out in the woods, it gets a little bit more difficult. You know, if you're lucky enough to find hornworms, you know, the big caterpillars, those are always fun, but you're a little bit early to find those. And again, they go so hot and cold, you're never quite sure where they are, so.
There you go. Mary in Appleton, we are on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. We have probably dozens of daddy long legs in our basement, and I would like to know how to get rid of them.
Okay. Now, the big question to me is it true daddy long legs, what we normally call, or there's something called a cellar spider, which is a very long-legged spider, and the way you would tell the difference is that the daddy long legs, or what we call opalinids, have a single body structure, whereas spiders have two segments to their body. They have the cephalothorax and the abdomen. Now, why the difference? Cellar spiders will breed and do quite well in that kind of environment, whereas the daddy long legs are outside critters that are wandering in. And so for one of them, it's more of a case of figuring how they're wandering in and getting it sealed up so they don't have access. If it's the cellar spiders, to be honest, I think a shop vac getting up into the all the corners of the basement and get into the sill plates and those kind of things, just getting back in there will reduce their numbers big time. But again, it is important to tell the difference because one, they're constantly migrating in, and that's how we head them off at the pass, whereas the other one could be breeding inside, and that's, as I said, where the vacuum cleaner would help.
And I've pretty much been vacuuming them up, but they keep coming back, and they are, I mean, everywhere in the basement. So it's, I mean, they're not localized to, you know, possibly they're coming in this area or possibly they're coming in another area.
Well, once the critters get in, though, they're going to just be wandering around. So I don't think you're going to see much of a pattern as far as the distribution. But, I would check any kind of furnace vents and those kind of things to make sure that they're caulked and sealed in. The other weakness of most of our homes is that where the siding meets the foundation, even though it doesn't leak energy, is often an access point for a lot of these things like millipedes and the like, where they crawl up in and then kind of fall into the basement. And then they're somewhat trapped and just kind of wander around. And so, as I said, sometimes just getting in with expanding caulk or foam on the outside makes a big difference for all kinds of things, ants, you name it. And it's one thing I wish that more professional pest services would offer that as an option, is to get somebody that really understands the structural dynamics of the house. And, you know, this also works against rodents, is, you know, you really know what you're doing, you get things fixed up.
We are having the outside of our house sprayed. Will that take care of, hopefully, if it's Daddy Long Legs coming in?
It will slow them down for a number of weeks. Eventually, those sprays decompose. And
right.
So, you know, you don't need them applied monthly, but, you know, sometimes it's a double service of both, you know, the spring and then a second one in the fall to stop some of these fall invaders. But, you know, the argument is if you do get things finally sealed up well enough, you're not going to need that service because things aren't going to get access.
Well, and it's actually more for the ones that are actually outside.
Mm-hmm.
You would have huge numbers of, I guess, garage spiders, and the spraying on the outside took care of those very nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, then as I said, that should be fine. It's just, you know, where they put the spray somewhat influences how long it will have a residual. And you do see some differences in different creatures as far as their susceptibility, you know, or that, you know, spiders are susceptible to one spray and millipedes with something else is a little bit better. But in general, the kind of chemicals they use are pretty broad spectrum.
Okay.
And should do a pretty good job. But as I said, if you have any questions, you can always send the critters down to me and we'll sort through
take
it pretty quick. So
there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Deborah in Wausau, it's your turn now. Hi, Deb.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling regarding powder post beetles.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I have a carpenter working at my home doing some repair work, and he sees evidence of, kind of spotty evidence of the beetles in the studs of the lower level.
Okay.
He's seeing some burrows and powder.
Okay. Do you know if those studs are softwood or hardwood?
I don't know what's normally used for.
Okay. Most of the time it's softwood. And I guess my first comment would be to make sure that it's active. And my first guess is it's not. Powder post beetles and the related anobiid beetles that get into the softwoods need some pretty high moisture content in the wood to stay happy. And typically the wood in our homes are too dry. You know, I see a lot of activity in old beams, in old houses, especially if they had dirt floor basements, that kind of thing. And, you know, you hit it with a hammer and you get all this kind of fine powder coming out. But to be honest, often the things have not been active for 20 or 30 years.
Well, interestingly, not to interrupt, but interestingly, the work that he's doing is repairing water damage. It's
okay.
Been present for a long time.
Okay. Well, you know, that could fuel it a little bit, but honestly, what you're doing with repairing it and getting things dried out is the best thing long term because, again, things will be too dry. I just am not expecting to have an active infestation of powder post beetles in the framing lumber in a home. Now, if you had a barn that was unheated or something, you know, we get this problem quite a bit in barn board. We get it in cabins that are not heated during the winter. And the difference is the moisture content of the wood, that in the homes that we live in year-round, they just dry out way too much, and the powder post beetles are not successful in breeding in them. And again, softwoods are far less prone. The beetles that get into softwoods even need a higher moisture content to stay happy. So I see them in unventilated crawl spaces and those kind of environments. But the conditions may have been right that they were active at some time, but my first guess is that they're not active. And
all right. The carpenter's question would be whether we should spray with some type of insecticide
No.
or whether those should be replaced altogether.
Well, from his standpoint, is it structurally sound? You know, if he starts poking at it and it's falling apart, then you got to replace the wood. But if it's structurally sound, I wouldn't worry about that. For when we do treat, the product that we're using for powder post beetle is a boric acid derivative called sodium octaborate. They sell it under the name Timbor or Boracare. And this stuff is painted or sprayed on and it diffuses in the wood. And what makes it different than a normal insecticide is it doesn't degrade. And because the powder post beetles are in the wood, you want something that's going to hold up. But again, before I went to that expense and bother, I would have to convince myself there are active critters in there. Okay. And, you know, I don't know if there's a real particularly bad board he can poke at, but one would expect to find larvae, little white grubs of one sort or another, or little brown beetles. That would be the active stage. The other thing you can tell sometimes is the consistency of the sawdust, or what we call frass, the debris. It's usually very whitish if it's fresh. If it's yellowish or orangish, it's old frass, and it's not from active infestations.
Okay, that's very helpful.
All right.
What would you say the name of the sodium borate?
The two commercial names you see it most common, Timbor, T-I-M-B-O-R, and that's a water-based powder. And then there is a glyco-based product, same active ingredient, called Boracare, B-O-R-A-C-A-R-E.
All right, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have Diane and Pepin wondering, if fake wasp nests work to keep yellow jackets and other wasps away?
Not that I'm aware of. I just can't see. I mean, again, insects are much more chemical orientated than visual, and I don't think they get faked out very much with that. So that would not be effective.
And Gina in Madison found a European rose chafer, Cetonia arata, is that how it's pronounced?
Mm-hmm.
On her foxglove plant last weekend. Have these been found in Wisconsin before? I was unable to find any records online.
Very few records. We know of the activity picking up in states around us. It's not that this is a state record, but they have been somewhat unusual. So
okay.
That one, to be honest, you can consider. There's a pest survey bulletin put out by the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, and the people there would be interested in that observation. If you can't get it, just email it to me, and I can get it over to those people. But they would be just interested for records, because that is a critter we're kind of watching.
Do they have a potential to be a big pest like the Japanese?
Well, they're an annual grub. To be honest, I think we got enough problem with Japanese beetle. I don't think they're going to hold a candle to it. In some parts of the country, at times, they get to be somewhat problematic. But, you know, it's one of these things. They've been around in the U.S. a long enough period of time. You would have thought if they liked Wisconsin that they'd be more prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to Ann in Madison next. Ann, hello to you.
Hi. Well, my Webster's has a very creepy definition of tick, and that is any of a large group of blood-sucking arachnids that are parasitic on man, cattle, sheep, etc., including many species that transmit diseases, along with an equally creepy little drawing of a tick. And when I was a kid, in a very hot and humid part of the East Coast, every kid who was planning to swim in a swimming hole or go to camp or spend any time in the woods in the summer had to get a tick shot. And I was wondering, at least I never got, you know, tick fever. That was what they were for. I wondered whether tick fever and Lyme disease are the same thing or related. And I haven't heard of people getting tick shots in recent years, and I wondered why.
Okay. Well, I assume what they were treating for out east is Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which is not a factor in Wisconsin. We got the right tick, but we don't have the disease. I think we've had like 5 confirmed cases in 30 years.
Oh.
Lyme disease is a different organism. It's a different tick, in fact, that's involved with the transmission. That one keeps going off the charts. We had a 35% increase in the number of cases last year, and it has been a constant rise in the last 12 years with Lyme disease. So that has continued to be an issue and will. In fact, it's interesting, as my study, my colleague Susan Paskowitz is studying some of the dynamics here of what's changing. And part of it seems to be the infectivity levels in the ticks.
Oh.
But the question is why?
So, we don't know yet.
Now, Lyme disease did have a human vaccine. Honestly, it didn't work that well. You needed a multiple booster shot, so that is off the market as far as I'm aware of. And I really was surprised on the tick shot. I wasn't aware that there was a Rocky Mountain spotted fever shot. But again, with it not being an issue in this state, it's not something that usually is there. But so I wouldn't see any reason for taking it if you lived in Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And Kim in Black Earth, your turn. Hi, Kim.
Hi, I got so inspired when I listened to your guest suggest that you seal your home better and stay away from those pesticides because, man, kudos to you. I just can't appreciate enough.
Oh, well,
thank you.
That's a nice comment.
Well, you know, the thing about you learn as a biologist, I guess, is that it's usually changing environments have more impact than any kind of magic chemicals people come up with. And so, you know, you really think some of these things through. And many times, as they said, it is kind of it's one of those da moments. You say, you know, think about this. There are different ways of solving these problems. And a lot of them are more permanent and definitely more effective than always relying on the spray. Unfortunately, there are times I get problems. I just don't know how else to deal with them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you. Yeah.
Appreciate the call. And Paul says in Madison, whenever my spouse spots a bite, anything other than a mosquito bite, he proclaims that it is a spider bite. Paula says, any suggestions on how I can defend the poor spiders?
Well, the first thing, it's cultural. We're all taught that, I guess. And the reality is that 98% of what we call a spider bite is not. One of the ways you would verify it's a spider bite is to look very closely, and spiders have two fangs. And so you see a double puncture mark, and you'll see that. I mean, if you get some magnification, you'll be able to see those two. So if you see a single probe, it's some insect of one sort or another, and there's a whole list of things that can do it. The other thing that we find is many spiders are not even capable of biting. They can't get enough leverage the way their fangs are orientated. Some of them, the fangs are not strong enough to penetrate human skin. So there's a whole bunch of arguments to suggest that, again, what we often will call a spider bite, that mysterious thing that shows up when you wake up in the morning, turns out is not.
On to Betty in Oak Creek. Hi, Betty.
For taking my call, and this is such an interesting program. Whenever you're on, once a month, I think. I have in the basement, well, I have them upstairs too, once in a while. I think it's a centipede, but I'm not sure. It has a million legs to it, and it's real crawly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that a centipede?
Yes.
And how do I treat that?
Well, I mean, centipedes, the one that we have indoors is kind of domesticated. It's a tropical species you don't find outdoors. And they are beneficial because they eat insects. So everything from ants to spiders to whatnot they can catch. And typically in the home, you don't have very many centipedes because there isn't a whole lot to eat. On the other hand, they're the creepiest looking things. You know, they're running around at night and you turn the light on, they go scurrying and hide underneath things. And they honestly do like environments that are a little damper.
Okay, that'd be the basement then.
Right, and so drying the basement will help. The reality is I'm not sure you can get it dry enough to eliminate them. One of the things that I suggest to people as a good option here, because it's honestly hard to spray concrete in the basement anyway with chemicals, but they use versions of this to catch mice. They call them glue boards. They also sell versions of this for catching insects, and you basically put these in like under the fridge or places where they might run. And if one runs by, it gets captured and it's dead. And so you have eliminated it from the population. And since these things are slow to breed, you don't have to kill very many of them to make things pretty good. Now, the problem is that there always potentially is a couple running in your wall voids in places you can't get to. So, but boy, I find it is a really pretty easy way to reduce the numbers. And as I said, you just kind of put these in places where they'll frequent. If you got pets, got to be a little careful because you don't want them to walk on the glue board or get stuck on their feet. But as I said, that's a pretty easy way of reducing centipede numbers.
It would be a glue board like what they use from those to catch mice?
Oh, yeah. They have versions big enough to catch rats, to be honest. And then they have mice. And then they have, you can find smaller versions that are a little bit easier to put in corners that are made for insects. But the whole thing are called glue boards.
Okay. So I can find that at my Ace Hardware or someplace.
Yeah. Hardware stores, discount stores, big box stores. I'm seeing glue boards quite common. As I said, if they don't have the insect version, just you can take a mouse version and cut it in half.
Yeah.
I would put that around the perimeter of the basement.
Yes, you can put it up in the seal plates, you know, just places where you've kind of seen them crawling around and whatnot. So,
thank you a million times over.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Betty. Appreciate your call. All right. We have Ross from Madison wondering why his chickens don't eat box elder bugs. I wonder if they resemble milkweed beetles.
Well, anything that is orange or red in the insect world, you get suspicious taste bad. It's an advertising gimmick on the insect's part, and that's what's going on here. Is box elder bugs do have a foul taste for a lot of creatures, and that's why the chickens learn real quick that that's not what they want to eat.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and post something there. Brian in Green Bay has a question for you, so let's go to Brian. Hi, Brian.
Morning, gentlemen. Was trying to find out about ants in the lawn. We've had lots of ant nests. I've tried putting a variety of different things on them, but don't seem to be able to get rid of them. And if I kill off one area, they seem to crop up in another in the front lawn. Right now I know I've got at least three active nests this spring so far. So.
The trick, you'll notice that a lot of products you use, almost instantly the ants are inactive and you think you won the war. But the trick with... they're probably field ants, which is an ant that doesn't come indoors, but it makes huge mounds outdoors, given the opportunity, and the colonies can live for 10 to 12 years. But there's a single queen, and she's a couple feet deep in the ground, and that's who we have to get to. And so what I find is the most effective way of dealing with it is not what you use, but how you use it. And typically what I suggest is to take a metal bar or a broom handle or something that I can poke three or four channels deep into the nest, as deep as I can, and one of the tricks I like to use is to rake the surface, and what you'll often see are the main tunnels that they're using, and that's where I'll poke down through and, you know, go as deep as I can. I'd like to get 18 inches or more, if possible. Then I mix my insecticide up in a bucket. It doesn't matter what you use as long as it says ants on the label. If I had to go buy something, the old Garden Insecticide 7, S-E-V-I-N, in the liquid form, and mix it up to normal recommendations, you know, teaspoon to a gallon, whatever it is, depending on the concentration. And then I pour it down those channel holes so that what I'm doing is penetrating deep. And I find by spot treating the nest that way, once in a while I have to come back and retreat a nest. But I find that to be the most effective way to deal with it. And then, again, if you've raked off that soil, then you can rake it back on and cap it so we don't have any insecticide exposed in the surface. And 7 is quite effective on ants to begin with, and it does degrade relatively quickly in contact with the soil. But as I said, if you can get these products down to kill the queen, the colony has no way of recovering.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Brett in Milwaukee says, every year I have a bee or wasp problem. They're usually always a nest in a tree, and then usually an underground nest near the house. Why do they like my yard so much and not the neighbors? Yeah.
Well, you know, different species. There are ground nesters and there are above ground nesters. And the ones in the trees, to be honest, as long as they're up above 10 feet, there's no reason to mess with them. Your biggest threat with wasp nests is when they're disturbed, they get very defensive. The ground nesting forms are looking for old gopher burrows, old washed out areas under slabs. And so one of the things you can try to do is reduce those environments as best you can in the spring. Because right now what's happening are the queens of the bumblebees and the yellow jackets and whatnot are all out cruising looking for places to set up their housekeeping. And now the other side of it that's interesting is that a lot of these species are predators, especially in the true wasp group on caterpillars and the like. So there's a good side to what they do. They feed on gypsy moths and that kind of thing. But the problem is if they're in an area of a lot of people traffic or pet traffic, as I said, because they're so defensive when things are going on, mowing the lawn or that kind of thing, then they do need to be dealt with.
We have Maynard in Milwaukee up next, and he posted a photo for us, too, here on the Facebook page. Hi, Maynard.
Ah. Well, hello, Phil. Hello, Larry.
Hi.
As you can see from the photo, I've photographed an unusual for me anyways, insect. That abdomen seems to, like, almost have a sort of hexagon shape. Wondered if you knew what it was.
Yeah, it's a Pelelucid wasp. These are parasites of grubs. And they use the long egg-laying device to get down into the soil to go after the grubs. And there is another species we've got that goes after wood-boring beetles, a different family, but the same type of incredibly long. So the hexagon shape is just because it's at rest. If it was normally flying or whatnot, it would extend that a little bit more. But, neat-looking creatures. That's a nice picture.
Yeah, it's a nice picture.
It is. Those back legs look pretty buff, pretty muscular.
Yeah.
Yeah, although that I'm not sure what the purpose on that one. You know, sometimes you see this in the front legs and you know it's for grasping things and whatnot, but not these guys. Now, on the other hand, they may need to have those back legs to get the leverage to get that egg-laying device down into the soil.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling, and that's a cool picture. If you want to see the photo, just go to the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and it pops right up. There it'll be.
You know, the digital camera, I tell people, is the greatest invention in my lifetime because, you know, so many people can take pictures, and it amounts to now about 40% of what I process in the lab are digital images that people send me. And most of the time, you know, a good picture like that is very easy to work with.
Mary wonders on our Facebook page, too, what's the best way to keep stink bugs from ruining my garden? Just keep them indoors like last year?
Well, you know, one of the disappointments for me this past 6 months is that we had our first intercepts of the brown marmot stink bug, which is the stink bug from causing all the problems out east, and now we're starting to see some records here. The only thing to do is when they start to feed and lay their eggs is to kill the nymphs. And honestly, soapy water works as well as many of the insecticides. And so you just keep your guard up. And if you see evidence of them being there, you treat. And unless you were to grow your plants in an indoor screen tent, I just don't know any other way to keep them away.
Sam and Birchwood, on to you now. Hi, Sam.
Hi. Well, Phil, I've gotten chigger bites fairly often in Missouri, but I didn't know there were chiggers in Wisconsin. But I feel absolutely certain that last summer in the Pepin area in early July while picking black raspberries, I got chiggers. So I was wondering how prevalent chiggers are in Wisconsin, maybe what their range is, and I was just curious.
Well, they're not as common as they are down south, but they're definitely chiggers out. And honestly, one of the places I would go to look for them is a raspberry patch. I don't know what the dynamics are there, but you find this quite common. And as I said, you can find them, if chiggers in Ashland, you can find them throughout the state. And it's a hard one to predict because sometimes people get them in the midsummer, sometimes people get them in the spring, sometimes they get them in the fall. And really, because it's a number of different species of mites, that explains, I think, some of this kind of diversity that you see. If you know an area that is prone to have them, consider using repellents. They use sulfur dust. Is tough on chiggers too. Probably a good thing to do when you're done picking the raspberries is get in and take a brisk shower and towel off real, because what you do is dislodge a lot of those mites before they get a chance to set up
dig
the feeding.
In. Yeah. Okay.
You know, that's what I do in chigger country. I like to just take a dive in a stream and scrub off real quick after I'm in the bushes, and it seems to work pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You're on the right track, Sam. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Don in Dousman with a question or comment. Hi, Don.
Hi. Hi, Phil. Nice talking to you. I wish I could listen to you every day. You're just great.
Thanks.
But the comment I have before that lady called about she wanted to spray chemicals everywhere around her house for those daddy long legs in her basement, isn't there the other way to tell the difference between the two is that other spider that she thought was a daddy long legs, they make a web and daddy long legs don't. Isn't that true?
Yes, that also would be a factor, definitely.
Yep.
Yeah, and over the years I've taught many people on spiders and they now save them instead of killing them. If we could get more spiders, we may not have as many as the other bad insects.
Yeah, they do a good job. Thanks, Don.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call. And Guy in Merrill, your turn. Hi, Guy.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
The question I got, I live on a farm in Merrill, Wisconsin, and I got a pop-up camper that we use pretty much all summer long. If we're not camping in it, you know, I set it up in the yard and the kids have a place to go in the summertime. But when it gets, you know, not so much during the summer, but when it gets nearer to fall, flies are looking for a place to live.
Yep.
To hibernate?
Yep.
Okay, now, when I go to close that camper up, I clean it, I disinfect it, I clean out all of, it's kind of gross, but I clean out all the flies and close it up tight, and then come springtime when I open it back up, I got to almost do the same thing over again.
Sure.
Is there a way to make that place uninviting?
Well, I, you know, the problem is I kind of, when you close it up, you know, you've got cluster flies. And, you know, the one thing is, honestly, if you had this in a real shaded area that didn't get sunny, to be honest, they probably wouldn't be attracted to the camper.
Oh, okay.
And the other problem is that when you're cleaning up, you're taking care of what you can get a hold of, but you wonder if some have already gotten into the walls of the camper and whatnot to hibernate, and those are the ones that are waking up in the spring and giving you trouble. You know, it just... You know, okay. If you got anything for them to crawl into at that time of the year, and you know, and they're crawling into, you know, firewood and you know, any seam of anything, but again, it all has to do with sun versus shade. They just aren't attracted to shaded areas.
Okay, so if I was to move that underneath a shade tree,
yep, it'll make a big difference. And you don't even worry about that until I'd say the last week of August, first week of September is when I would start to get my guard up.
Okay.
All right. Thank
you. Well, great. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Guy. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network, talking the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you listening in. Lots of callers online, and I think we'll just go right to the phones here. And Carl in Wyawega has been waiting a while, so let's go to Carl. Hi, Carl.
How you doing?
Good.
I got a question. How do you get rid of earwigs?
My solution is to make your whole yard a sandbox, and you wouldn't have earwigs. it's an environmental
thing. Way.
Yeah, you know, because right now they are in the ground. They'll be coming out shortly as half grown. Their moms have already taken. I mean, it's a real interesting behavioral trait that the female earwig does take care of her small young. So they come out of the ground and they run around at night, and they like plants to feed on, but they also eat insects, and so they're what we call omnivorous. And then when the sun comes up, they hide under things that are cool, damp, and dark, so under flower pots, and that's what forces them indoors. And so, you know, if you've got a lawn or flower garden or vegetable garden and it's mulched and it's wet, I mean, that's just a perfect environment for them to live in. You know, indoors is a dead end. You know, they come indoors, they can't breathe, there's nothing to eat, and so I don't worry about them indoors, but people don't like the idea of them being inside.
The only thing I've heard how to keep them out of the house is to put, like, little dishes of, like, peanut oil or something, and they'll go in that, and then they'll die.
Well, I've even had luck. It's all kinds of things that attract them. I've taken old tuna fish cans and sunk them in flush with the ground and added just a little bit of oil because it holds up better than soapy water, and they come into that and die. But I think the thing that, I mean, the number of earwigs in the average backyard in a good year is staggering. I mean, we're talking hundreds, if not thousands, and it's just an occasional one that gets indoors. Again, like we had talked in the earlier part of the show about if critters are getting in easy, if you could figure out how they're getting in and get it sealed up, that's a good solution. The other thing that people will do sometimes is not quite as exaggerated as a big sandbox, but the less vegetation you have next to the house, the better. Sometimes people, you know, we do this in food facilities, is they'll put a 18-inch or 2-foot wide area of gravel right next to it. So there's no plants, there's nothing other than the stonework. And as I said, that's almost like a barrier that they don't want to cross.
Okay, because I got a whole patio on my front door, and they're just, what they do is they walk right across the patio, and if my wife leaves the light on because I work second shift, they'll go right on that patio, and they'll come right in the house.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They squeeze under anything. You know, and it's not so much the lights you have on at night. It's again, when the sun comes up, they're looking for places to get away, and that's what forces them under door sweeps and all kinds of places and puts them inside.
There you go.
So in other words, the best way is to dump sand all over the house.
Well, a couple things that you might consider. I mean, this depends on how much work you want to put into it. There's a product called diatomaceous earth. And basically what this is an abrasive product. And if you were to blow this up in all the cracks and crevices they crawl through, that would be a way of kind of a semi-permanent keeping them out. But the question is, can you find all the places they're sneaking in?
Yeah, that's the deal. Good luck, Carl. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Susan in Appleton up next. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have an infestation of flies in our pantry. This is a problem that we had last summer. It's the kind of fly that you sometimes see in flour. It's just about a half an inch, and it's I think it makes like egg sacs that are kind of like a little string that's kind of sticky and whitish. And
are you sure they're not moths?
Tell me the difference.
Well, a moth, you know, has two pairs of wings, and if you were to crush a moth because they have little scales on it, they're very powdery. True flies have one pair of wings, and other than we had talked earlier about these moth flies, most flies don't have any kind of scalings or stuff on their wings. The reason I say is the food substrate is just what I would expect. Basically, it's beetles and moths I find out of stored food products.
Okay. Now, the other, I'm looking at one right now, and I'm trying to see if there's two sets of flies or of wings here or not. But another thing that I've noticed in there is that I store baskets in there as well. And under some of the baskets, there was like a powdery substance, and it seems that they're being eaten. So I don't know if something was in those as well.
Let's
but what I did last fall, I cleaned everything out. I threw away any flour, crackers, anything, and then I kind of double bagged or put things in another container if it's been open. We didn't have any problems all winter, and now all of a sudden, every morning, our ceiling in there is covered with these little critters.
Okay.
And they don't move quickly at all. They're easy to kill, but mm-hmm. they're just, I don't know what to do.
Well, I think you were heading the right direction, because if it is any one of these dry goods pests, is sanitation is what it's all about, is you seal things in containers that they can't get into, but things that people overlook. And this is what it would suggest to me is that, you know, I don't know if you got a bag of dog treats somewhere, or
no,
they get into spices, they get into potpourri,
okay.
they get into dried flower arrangements. Anything that's dried plant material is a food substrate. And so typically when we get a flaring like this, they found another food. But the other thing that I would consider is that if they weren't active in the winter, the food could have been too cold for them to develop wherever this was. And now that things have warmed up, that started it all over again. You can always take a picture of the critter and email that to me, and we can see what we can do with it, or you can send me the critters. But as I said, my first guess is they are Indian meal moths, which is a very common pantry pest, and they are notorious for starting in one thing and then laying their eggs and getting into other things. And as I said, I'm also a little concerned that the stuff that is in the baskets is a different critter that sounds like it might be powder post beetle, because they leave a very fine, almost talcum powder-like debris when they are feeding. Those baskets could be frozen. As a way of killing the powder post beetles, or heated.
Okay, can I? Now I would try. I've been trying. I just put some bleach in water, and I was letting them soak in water. Will that do it or not?
No, it sterilizes them. But
okay.
It's interesting when we are working with insects in the lab, and we want to sterilize them. We sterilize the outside surface with bleach water.
Oh.
You know, and it really, I mean, at some concentrations it will kill, but generally speaking, it doesn't. And so, although it's good for killing germs, it's not the way to go with insects. And
okay.
As I said, I would consider taking it in just bagging it and putting it in, if you've got a deep chest freezer, and leaving it in there for a couple of days. And that usually takes care of any of those kind of critters that get in the wicker.
There you go. Thank you for calling. You know, sort of on a similar line here, Pat says we had a bag of corn in the basement, and now we have what we think are corn weevils.
Mm-hmm.
All over. They're now starting to show up upstairs. How do we get rid of them?
Well, if it's true weevils can only breed in whole grain, so it would make sense coming out of it. But what else do you have? You could have some peas or beans that they might get into, but this is, again, you get rid of the source, they're gone, but you may get a trickling. It may take 2 or 3 weeks for things to settle down. My argument would be is if they don't settle down, they found a bag of
something else.
But it's got to be seeds, whole seeds, because true weevils won't breed in flour. They won't breed in pancake batter. They need a whole seed to develop in.
Diane in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
I'm wondering about these webs that we find oftentimes early in the morning, spider webs, that is. Sometimes it's just one strand. But it goes from one side of the road all the way to the other. And
mm-hmm.
it can be 4 to 6 feet off the ground. And we're talking across a road that's maybe 16, 20 feet wide.
Yeah, spiders do some interesting things. I mean, one of the tricks smaller spiders can do is called ballooning, where they attach and they literally ride the strand out. But I think typically more common is you do find spiders that will walk in, you know, do the big U, if you think about it, and tighten up. It just depends on what's going on. But it's amazing how much can be done in a given night.
Wow.
Yeah. And they make some fantastic webs overnight.
Yeah. But as I said, this phenomenon of ballooning, I mean, that's how spiders get around is, and you'll notice this when you're gardening sometimes, is all of a sudden you bump in and there's this big long strand that might be, you know, 10, 12 feet long and a spider on at the end of it. But you think about it, that gives enough resistance that it can catch in the wind and they literally can float a good long distance.
Mm-hmm. I'll be darned.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Lori and Lily, your turn. Let's see, I'll get you on here. Hi, Lori.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
On the subject of spiders, I wish I had your knowledge. I found a black spider under my dog's blanket on the couch when I lifted it up. I had a red spot on it.
Mm-hmm. It's probably what we would call a Salticeter jumping spider. They often are black, velvety colored with either white, cream, or orange or red markings. They're harmless. They're as the name implies, they pounce on their prey. They're very visual. They've got, for spiders, all spiders have either 6 or 8 eyes, and they have one pair of just huge eyes, because that's what they do, is they see their prey, whereas some spiders do all their stuff by feel. And you do find them indoors on occasion. They don't, not real common indoors. And not,
well, that's
the point.
What I'm concerned about is any spiders that would be harmful to me or my dog.
Yeah, no, definitely nothing to worry about with jumping spiders.
One quick more question. There was a black one when I moved in last fall. It had a round body, kind of shiny, and it had stumpy legs that had like rosebush spikes all over it.
The spikes throw me a little bit because I was thinking there's a common one called Stidodia. It's a comb-footed spider. That you see indoors. In fact, honestly, it's a distant cousin, but not dangerous like the Black Widow.
Because it's, thick legs. It's not thin legs.
It could be a wolf spider. And we do, you know, probably half the spiders people send me are not indoor spiders, but they're outside spiders that wandered in by accident.
There was a giant one that was quarter size up on my wall the other night.
Yeah, well, we get a lot of wolf spiders and fishing spiders, which are the two of the biggest spiders we have in the state. And again, they're not indoor spiders. They're harmless, but they're nighttime hunters. So they're out wandering around. Okay. And again, when the sun comes up, they will wander inside.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And a Facebook question from Ann. I got a ton of dozens of spiders on the siding of my house on warm evenings. They have large thorax, long legs, and look black at night, but are tan with dark markings on their thorax in the light. Suggestions on how to get rid of them. Their average size is the width of a fingernail with their legs, though we have one with a thorax the size of my thumbnail at one point.
Okay. Well, I would have to see. I mean, in order to really identify spiders, I need to see the eyes, to be honest. And so it's hard from the description. But the first thought when somebody tells me you have a lot of spiders, there has to be a lot of food for the spiders to eat, which is usually insects. Mm-hmm. And the most common phenomenon that we see is it's the security lighting that people have that draw the insects in, and the spiders are taking advantage of this. And if you've got loose siding, they got lots of little habitats to be into. But again, and this comes to us from what we do and we're advising people that are, you know, building manufacturing plants, is if you need security lighting, you can put it above the door and draw all the bugs to the house, or you can put it up on a pole and shine it on the door. And so you still get the same effect, but you draw all the bugs to the pole away from the house. And so that would be the first thought, is to see if there's some adjustments you can make to your lighting that will be less inclined to draw in insects. One of the other options is to use the less attractive lights, you know, the mercury vapors and the yellows and whatnot. They make special lighting that's less attractive, and see if we can manipulate it from that side of things, that if there's less spider food, there's less spiders. There are sprays. To be honest, the better spider sprays are somewhat selective. In other words, some things that you use in the garden would not be good choices for spider sprays, and they do make special formulations that stick to substances a lot better. So they're made for putting on siding and the like, and usually one application of that, but you almost have to power spray it. So I'm not talking a can of Raid. I'm talking about, you know, some kind of sprayer. And so they said, I think the first way I would approach it is see if we can cut down on the potential food and see if that lessens the problem.
Stephanie in Chicago. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about the identity and ultimately the way to get rid of a small brown fly that's infested my house in Chicago. Interestingly, my mother also had a tremendous infestation of these, and she lives in Minnesota. And they're just, they're new to me. They're just a small, about half the size or a third the size of a regular house fly. They're brown and very triangular, very like equilateral, kind of a wide wings. Hearing the lady talk about moths, I thought maybe they are a moth, but the wings are translucent.
Okay.
And,
well, the thing to look for on the internet, and this is just to verify, I'd be happy if you send one up to identify it, but from your description, there's something called a moth or drain fly, and it's a true fly, but it looks like a moth, so it's kind of, it looks like a cross, even though that's not what it is. And we had talked about it earlier on the show, is
right.
You see the adults, but what you have to do is trace the source of the breeding, and you probably aren't going to see the maggots. But it has to be something that is wet and has organic matter. And so floor drains in the basement, overflow cuts in bathroom sinks, in tubs. And sometimes I see if we got leaky toilet seals or whatnot, that will create the right environment. And so the problem is you see the fly in one spot, but the hot spot somewhere else. And usually, you know, using a very hot pail of water down the floor drain makes a big difference. In the case of the overflow cut, you almost have to get it washed out somehow by using a plunger or using hot water or using some kind of scraper. Again, what you're trying to do is dislodge that kind of slimy buildup, because that's what the maggots are feeding on, and that's what you result in the fly. So it's all a point source. It doesn't do any good to spray, because you're just killing the adults and the problem is still going on. So this is kind of tracing it back. And as I said, you can look on the internet under moth fly or drain fly and just see if that image fits what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here's one other clue. The infestation that my mother had in her apartment was in a plastic bag that was protecting a quilt, you know, a cotton quilt, probably cotton polyester quilt. And she was going to take the quilt out, and the bag was literally covered with flies on the inside.
Hmm. That would not be, as I said, it would not fit the habitat of these because it's too dry to be, and
right.
I can't see what they would
might
eat.
Might be two different
yeah.
insects going there.
But said, you can always send them up to the insect lab at 1630 Linden, Linden Drive. The university zip is 53706. Or take a digital picture, and you can email it to me. It's got to be a reasonable picture. You know, it can't be just a little black smudge, but if it's got some clarity, I should be able to verify it. And as I said, from your mom's situation, it just doesn't fit. Now, I've got critters like psyllids that come from the trees that grow outside that invade people's houses and show up. And so there's a lot of things that would kind of fit this little gnat-like description. And that's why, unfortunately, a lot of times when people say, oh, I got these little flies, I usually say, boy, I'd really like to see one because I need to see them close up to make sure.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll give that a try.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Sally in Madison. Your turn. Hi, Sally.
Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a creepy crawler under the soil. And when I called in, I thought it was a slug. But then when the person taking the call said, oh, we already did grubs, but we haven't done slugs, I said, well, maybe that's what I have. So I called my husband, and we looked at the pictures on the web, and he said we have both in our soil. Is
mm-hmm.
that possible?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, in fact, even grub's kind of a generic term. To an entomologist, grub is the immature stage of a beetle. And although we have white grubs that are quite common, there are dozens of other species you could find.
Okay, because ours are more like light gray.
Okay. Well, slugs, I mean, the first way you would tell the difference is slugs don't have any legs.
Okay.
And there are some maggots that don't have legs. But,
okay.
And the thing about grubs is that some of them are predators, so there's some beneficial ones that are out there, and other ones are root feeders. And so, again.
Yeah, he had trouble with his tomatoes last year, and we thought it was from those creepy crawlers.
It's possible, but not likely. I mean,
oh.
When I start hearing about tomato problems, one of the questions I ask, are there any walnut trees close by?
No, but there was.
Ah, well, that's your problem. There's a chemical that walnut gives off called jugolone that is toxic, especially to tomatoes. I mean, that's why the first thing, you know,
and it was a container. It was a big pot, but the beetles, larvae, or whatever it is, were coming up through the bottom hole. So he moved the containers onto bricks to try to get them off of the soil.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But and we put this white stuff all over the ground under it. But the slugs are the grubs are still there. I went out to turn some soil, and it was all full of these little things. And then I saw something that was like a Japanese beetle grub.
Sure.
And we have so many of those Japanese beetles around that I thought maybe that could be it, too.
Probably. I don't see Japanese beetle grubs causing much trouble to the roots of tomatoes in particular. And if you've got good organic matter, there's all kinds of creatures that are just associated with normal decay. And so the mere presence of critters doesn't suggest, and as I said, for tomatoes, it's interesting. On the disease side, there's all kinds of headaches that you have. But generally speaking, serious insects on tomatoes in Wisconsin aren't really that common. And so when I hear of plants in decline, I'm usually looking in a direction other than insects as the cause.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Oh, wait, how do I get rid of them? Or don't I?
Well, the question is, you need to, and as I said, if I knew what it was, then I could give you. But my gut
right
feeling.
Right over to Linden Drive. Thank you.
All right, there you go. Thanks very much for calling. Got a caller from Appleton would like you to comment on micro scorpions. The caller has found three in his Appleton house in the last 5 or 6 years.
Pseudoscorpions. They're beneficial. They feed on little carpet beetles and ants and those kind of things. They don't bite people. Generally, like they're seeing, it's just an occasional one. Usually they're hiding back in closets and stuff, and they're out looking for something to eat at night. I have had one case in my career that I still can't explain of somebody in the Fond du Lac area that literally could find 10 a day for 2 months straight, and I still have no idea how and why they had those kind of populations. But again, predators, relatively slow to breed. And to me, more of a curiosity. They look mean. You get one cornered. You know, they're pretty small, but you get one cornered, and they flail these pincer-like on their front pair of legs, like they're real mean and scary. But they're just doing that for show.
All right, there we go. And boy, we're starting to run out of time here. I have quite a few more emails and quite a few more callers online here, Phil. But I think we're going to have to call it a day. Have you heard? I think you just did hear about an exhibit at the Chicago Field Museum. It's called "The Romance of Ants," and it's about ants and the lives of ants. And that should be pretty cool to see.
Well, ants are so sophisticated in the insect world, and just so fascinating. And they do so many things we still don't understand. And in fact, E.O. Wilson, who's the great ant scientist and also quite a biologist, has got some great writings. If you ever want to have entertainment, get a hold of one of E.O.'s books.
E.O. Wilson?
E.O. Wilson, yes.
E.O. Wilson. Well, as a matter of fact, Judith is going to be filling in for me tomorrow, and she's going to be talking with Corey Moreau, and Corey is the curator of the Romance of Ants exhibit at Chicago's Field Museum, so that should be a lot of fun tomorrow at 11 o'clock. You should tune that.
Well, I'll try to pick it up, definitely.
You should tune in for
that. I should be done lecturing by then, so it should work pretty good.
Okay. Well, that's at 11, and then at 11:45, she's going to visit with staffers from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and it's an interesting topic, too. They're going to be talking about some innovative engine design. So that's all coming up tomorrow. Thanks to Phil. Thanks to you for listening here on the Ideas Network.